This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
I'm Natalia Melman Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2. And of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
If I talk about Mars, I get to talk about everything. I can talk about things like what's the boundary between life and non-life. I get to talk about the climate emergency. I get to talk about Silicon Valley billionaires and the gap between the rich and the poor that is ever widening by the day. I get to talk about AI. The second you start thinking about Mars, it's this really important symbol for so many different people. Focus on that, you get to talk about the entire world.
However you imagine the creative life or working practices of an opera composer, I doubt you visualise someone recording the sound of Martian dust.
It feels like coarsely ground sugar.
Or messing around with a tank of helium.
So you can get this very sort of industrial sound of like a valve being released.
You're listening to the documentary In the Studio from the BBC World Service, which looks inside the workings of the world's most inventive artistic minds. I'm Katie Derham, and in this episode, I'm trying to keep up with Irish contemporary composer and vocalist Jennifer Walsh.
How slowly can I move from one pitch to another? So instead of going,
Jennifer has created musical works inspired by Barbie dolls, skateboarding, and the meaning of time itself. She's a polymath who sees meaning in unlikely places, humour in the absurdity of everyday life, and who somehow brings all this together into deeply moving performances. Now she's launching herself into a whole new orbit with an opera about Mars, working title Mars 24. I first catch up with Jennifer at the University of Oxford, where she's Professor of Composition.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Walsh. I'm a composer and a performer, and you're interviewing me in my office here at the University of Oxford. I'm in Worcester College.
And there's a lot of change going on around us in the form of cardboard boxes and a nascent studio.
I would say there's not just change going on within my office, but I think there's change going on across the entire university and across the entire world. So it feels normal.
Change going on not just across the whole world, but the universe, which leads us neatly to your current project. Tell us about what is going on with the Mars project.
Well, I've been obsessed with Mars since I was a child. And a couple of years back, I was thinking about what larger subject areas I'd be interested in working in. I had written an opera about time. So I'd spent a lot of time thinking about what time is. And I live in London. So I'd been visiting, you know, the Greenwich Meridian a lot. I'd been visiting a specific dinosaur at the Natural History Museum an awful lot. That sort of way of like going back again and again to these things and thinking about them. That was really a fantastic experience. And I felt it made my work deeper and it made me a better person. So when I was thinking about new projects that I would like to do one day, I was just thinking about Mars and I thought, oh, that's it.
Jennifer's long voyage to a brand new Martian opera has had many pit stops along the way. For the last 4 years, she's been creating smaller works that push forward her understanding of the Red Planet and how to approach it as a composer.
I didn't want to just spend 1 year or 1.5 years researching it and then make a piece. I knew it needed to be multi-stage. I also knew that as those years unfolded, our relationship to Mars would change. So when I was starting on all this, Perseverance rover blasted off and then landed on Mars, I don't think I'm going to get to the point where humans are going to set foot on Mars, but there will be another step that we take towards going to Mars.
Jen's first stop was Mars 1,
a musical theatre piece about two astronauts lost in space. It played with the ludicrous, unglamorous, mundane realities of space travel.
What I was interested in was trying to examine these long durations. You know, durations where it's a bit boring, durations where they get lonely, durations where inevitably they're just telling terrible jokes.
They ask us a question. It takes 20 minutes to get to us. We answer the question, and it takes another 20 minutes to get to them. We say, knock, knock. 40 minutes later, we hear a, who's there?
So to try to get some of that sense that space travel is not fast and zippy and people don't all dress in athleisure, I was interested in that first piece.
Jen then made an ASMR piece called Next Stop Mars, which used all kinds of Martian ephemera, including NASA-grade artificial Martian dust.
Mohave Martian simulant was developed for scientists at NASA and JPL so that they could test equipment with the closest possible analogue to Martian regolith.
Even though you're hearing lovely crinkly sounds, and I could have ostensibly made those with, you know, a bag of lentils, I know they're coming from this Martian simulant.
It's coloured a deep brown red.
I also know I'm using freeze-dried food of the sort that astronauts eat. That was like a way to think about the sonic aspects of what you're going to get in space, what you're going to get on a space station.
Freeze-dried ice cream.
Subsequently, she produced a piece for Chamber Ensemble, Some Notes on Martian Sonic Aesthetics 2034 to 51, analysing the cacophony of machines that astronauts are surrounded by.
That sort of hard sci-fi approach was really interesting for me because you start to unpack all of these layers of, well, what would it sound like? What would it really sound like to be up there? How might music develop if you're always in a context where there's never a quiet, you know, unnoisy environment? That sort of provides this ambient background to thinking about an opera.
The grand finale to all these exercises to capture the red planet in sound and music will be Mars 24, which has been commissioned by Irish National Opera. At its heart, the story of four female astronauts.
At the moment, we're not sure if they're on their way to Mars and on Mars or just on Mars, but we know that they've left Earth. That's for sure. They're not on Earth.
It's being written in collaboration with Mark O'Connell, an award-winning Irish journalist whose most famous work is a non-fiction book about transhumanism called To Be a Machine.
I thought, I think I need somebody like Mark, who is a non-fiction writer, who writes a lot about tech and science and Silicon Valley. But that was sort of the start of it, is that you have somebody that you can bounce ideas off and you can think things through together. The other way of thinking about it is you think about it as an opera. You think about what does the stage look like, constantly looking at other work, thinking about Mars. To be honest, that's what all artists do. They're like the worst people to go to the theatre with or, you know, an exhibition with because they're just going, no, I would have done it like this. Or that's great, I'm going to steal that, but that's terrible. I will never do that. Like, so I think there's always that self-reflectiveness going on.
Music first or words first, generally?
Both. It sort of depends. Like, I certainly might zone in on a sort of a vibe, as my students would say, where there's maybe just sort of a feel that I want, and I'll just start making as much material as I can. There's like two types of composers. There's composers who come in to these projects where they're like, here's the libretto, and now I sit down and I write all the music that goes with the libretto. For better or for worse, I tend to work with people where we're developing this stuff and pinging it back and forth, and you can't quite say what something means until the last moment.
So we are in March 24 now. This was originally going to be put on in July. That's been put back. Talk us through the timeline now.
At the moment, I'm working on the piece. The planning has been put in position. Mark O'Connell as the librettist, Aideen Cosgrove, who's a fantastic set designer, costume designer, amazing lighting designer, and Tom Creed and myself will co-direct. It's now the part of the process where it's really down to me just putting the days in, getting enough work done that I can send chunks of it over to Mark. So we've had lots of WhatsApps about things that we're interested in.
I think think actually there's a little shortcut we can take.
Jennifer wants to show me one Martian artifact that sparked her interest.
We can cut across.
En route to Oxford's Natural History Museum, she tells me how reading science fiction has also been shaping her ideas.
The real promise of sci-fi is that you can actually think about today. When I read Pattern Recognition by William Gibson, that really struck with me because that's like a novel that's set in the contemporary world. He describes in an interview how he was writing the novel in late 2001, summer of 2001. He was working on the novel. He woke up on September 11th, saw the news, and after 2 weeks of shock, went back to try and start the novel again and realised that he couldn't write the same novel. That's very interesting because theoretically, if you're writing sci-fi, what happens on Earth shouldn't really matter because you should just be able to just keep going with your sci-fi story. Gibson couldn't do that, and then he ripped it all up and then he started Pattern Recognition, and that was set in the present day. But I find myself coming back to that stuff again and again. I should get that mouse.
That was a good one, wasn't it?
So that's it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's tiny.
I mean, yeah,
it's tiny.
So this is the Chessigny meteorite fragment found in France in 1915. Okay.
When I got the job here at Oxford, I saw that they had some Mars meteorites in their holdings, and so I was very excited, and I contacted Duncan McMurdoch, who took me up backstage and let me hold some pieces of Martian meteorites. But there were several things that Duncan talked to me about, and one was just like the coloration that you can see if you strain your eyes, this faint, do you know what I mean, rusty color that, you know, we're familiar with from the surface of Mars.
Because it says on the little explanatory board here that this is composed of the green mineral olivine.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, even though there is a greenish tinge to it, beneath that there is that sort of classic Mars orange.
The other thing that Duncan told me, which really stuck in my mind, was he showed me these cross-sections of meteorites where you could see these circles which contain these amino acids that could be the building blocks of life. I realised, oh, I have to be able to show this to the audience. And so I went and I bought a tiny sliver of a different meteorite. And not only that, Duncan recommended this really specific type of microscope, which is almost like a torch that has a microscope built into it. And then I ended up using that as part of the live setup for the piece, The Percussionists Man That. And they loved using it. That's the thing, is when you come to these spaces and you talk to people, you get loads and loads of ideas for even scenic things that you never would have predicted that you'd do in a piece.
So do you think there's anything from, whether it's this little meteorite fragment or the one which is too expensive to be on display, that will then somehow find a place in Mars 24?
I think part of it's just knowing that it's here. I have this theory that if you go to natural history museums and you just look at one thing and you stay there for a very, very, very long period of time, you can just about begin to understand how old the universe is. I remember being in the Natural History Museum in London, and there was this sign that said, this is one of the oldest rocks you'll ever touch. It's from this specific part of Greenland. It's billions of years old. I was like touching the rock. And then my phone went ding and I picked it up, and it was my friend David, and it said, FML, I just had an allergic reaction to anti-aging skin cream. And I thought, that's human life. You're really just a tiny speck in the scheme of things, you know, and that's actually quite a good feeling to have. So that's why I like to come to these places.
Great. I really love your brain.
Oh, God. Thanks very much. I feel so waffly today. So please edit me.
No, but I think
you can touch this one. Look, here's one of these 4.5 billion years old.
You see, I have no concept of that.
My theory is you need to spend at least 30 minutes just staring at that and nothing else.
Let me just remind you that you're listening to the documentary In the Studio from the BBC World Service. I'm Katie Derham, following composer Jennifer Walsh as she prepares for her upcoming Mars opera.
I'm Sarah Trelevin, and for over a year, I've been working on one of the most complex stories I've ever covered.
There was somebody out there who was faking pregnancies.
I started, like, warning everybody. Every doula that I know.
It was fake.
No pregnancy.
And the deeper I dig, the more questions I unearth.
How long has she been doing this?
What does she have to gain from this?
From CBC and the BBC World Service, The Con, Caitlin's Baby.
It's a long story. Settle in.
Available now.
We next catch up with her in her home studio.
I'm very lucky to have this whole room in London. A lot of people don't even have a room for their studio, but there's a lot of stuff in it. And so I try to keep it organized so I can put my hands on things.
We're now right at the beginning of June. I've generated, I don't know, maybe 60 to 80 minutes worth of material. I want to generate probably another half an hour more.
This morning I was working on a section playing around with these spring drums, which make these quite subtle sounds, and then you can make them make sort of thunder and lightning sounds and things like this. So, you know, try ideas out and get all sorts of different sounds.
What I try to do is I go into the studio and think, do I want to go in and do the fine brushwork? Or do I want to generate something from scratch? Or do I have some objects that I just got in the post and I want to like play around with them and I don't even know what they're going to mean?
I was trying to think about visual ways to represent speed of something, and I got really into spinning tops.
Because I was a trumpet player for years, a lot of what I'm interested in terms of thinking about the soundscape on a spaceship is that you have machinery going the whole time. You have valves releasing air.
If you put it at the bell, it's not going to be loud. Whereas like the flute is a bit more subtle in that there's all these keys on the flute that you'd never normally touch. But if I go,
it really is generous of Jennifer and rare for any composer to share their methods and music at such a delicate stage of the composition process.
What I do is I create what I call nodes. So nodes are like little bits of material that, like, some of them are 9 minutes long, some of them are a minute long.
For example, this one.
But I'm also starting to think about the bits of material that connect bits of material. And I am at the point now where I need to start notating things in much more detail, which is, as any composer will tell you, is a nightmare. In terms of the entire narrative, I suppose now I'm taking my mother's advice as a writer. I don't want to talk about it because there's so many different tendrils that I think they need to just be floating there in space, ready to be followed down. There's lots of different ways that it can go right now.
One aspect of Jennifer's process that is always guaranteed is humour.
I think what Mark and I share is this interest in just the ludicrousness of existence. So it's not even that we're trying to be funny, we're just sort of trying to point out how absurd things are. What I was working on this morning before you came was this one here. So this was one where they discover that the Criterion Collection was deleted and they didn't bring all the movies they thought they were going to watch on the way to Mars. In my head, I'm also thinking about the staging when I'm doing these things. This person is at the front and they're in the sort of a spotlight and the scene seems to be about them. But then there's these three idiots in the background arguing about the hard drive, trying to play with ideas of how humans talk to one another and how humans really talk to one another.
You did. Can you just take a look at this for me? Like, I don't understand. How do we only have Shrek the Third?
One online resource which has been invaluable has been the real recordings of Life in Space from the International Space Station.
Because there's so many recordings from the ISS, but they're really, really noisy. So when you listen to the ISS, it sounds... Oh no, is this playing? No. So like that's the noise floor. You're in this environment where it's incredibly loud and there's all these machines that if they switch you off, that means you're dead. And so I took those and I thought, I want to have a relaxing version of this, which would be all of the pitches that would be present in that, but I can transcribe them and have them for instruments. So that is, where is it here? It's this one. So... So that is like a transcription of what you just heard of the ISS.
We left Jennifer to continue composing in her studio for the rest of the year, coming together again at the start of 2025 in what feels like a markedly different and increasingly space-obsessed world, though still with the same old tech problems.
Hey, hey.
Hello.
Hello, hello.
Oh, you're back.
Hi, Jen.
Hello.
You keep cutting out and I'm not hearing you at all.
Jen, if you can hear me, and I can't hear you, but if you can hear me, we're just going to literally call you on the phone.
Sorry, what do you want to do?
Jen, hello. Let's start again. Okay, so it's now January 25. It's very good to see you. It's been many months. How is Mars 24 going? How's the project going?
Well, I'm now in the notation part of it. So there's still bits that are being finished up and scenes that need to be written. So I'm sort of in deadline mode, working till 9, 10 p.m. every night. And I'm beginning to have a sense of how it all fits together.
It feels like we're now at the hurtling towards the finishing line stage of the process. And yet, obviously, there were some delays last year. Just going back in time a little, what were the holdups? What were the issues? Were the challenges in particular, or was it just something that evolved?
Any creative process is going to have delays and challenges. That's just part of it. It usually follows the same pattern. You know, people start, they're really, really excited. In the middle, it's a slog and there's times when you want to give up. And then gradually, you know, you can sort of see some sense coming out of the mountain of material.
Will it still be called Mars 24?
We're still fixing the title. It might just be called Mars. Right now, I'm wearing a T-shirt that I bought from NASA that says Perseverance, you know, Mars 2020. Didn't land on Mars until 2021. I'm trying to have the same project management attitude as a NASA manager.
She might not have the title, but Jennifer's got her venue. Leisureland, a sports centre meets events venue in Galway, Ireland, that sounds just suitably irreverent for a Jennifer Walsh opera.
You know, there's a swimming pool attached to it. There's a fierce smell of chlorine when you walk in, which I liked because all astronauts train in swimming pools, the neutral buoyancy pools. It's this huge space that's painted an extremely deep purple. And so Aideen Cosgrove, the person who's doing stage design and lighting, she went to see it and she absolutely loved it because she said, we can make it feel like space. We can gesture to the loneliness and the isolation of space, but we can also gesture to massive distances.
Alongside all the ordinary preparations for premiering a major new work, Jennifer and her team have been responding to extraordinary news headlines. And just like her belief that the best sci-fi tells us something about life on Earth, that has become remarkably true for this project.
The plot, as it unfolds in the first half, is that we have these four astronauts. They're going to Mars, and they're going because they're specialist scientists who are going to drill for water. And as they get closer to Mars, they discover that a Silicon Valley billionaire has effected a sort of a hostile takeover of, let's say, NASA and ESA. And so the space agencies are no longer non-profit. They're now in the hands of private capital. So their mission changes. We sort of joke amongst the team that prior to the US elections last November, we were writing a sci-fi opera. And after the elections, we're now writing a sort of a social realist opera in the style of Mike Lee.
And did it feel at that point after the election in November that you suddenly entered a new gear, if you like? You sort of thought, right, we're definitely going down that route now.
We were always going down that route because certainly this is where we felt we were headed. We're sort of very aware that all of a sudden we have something which is insanely topical. And so we want to A, make sure we do it right. B, we're very aware that all manner of things could happen between now and when the opera opens at the end of July. And we're also aware of the fact that people might be utterly sick of Silicon Valley billionaires who want to go to space. And so we also have to handle that in a very specific way.
And also, and this is just pure coincidence, but we're at a time in the calendar when you can actually see Mars with the naked eye. It brings it really genuinely quite close to home, doesn't it?
I'll tell you, the spectacle of me leaving my Oxford office, and when I come out in the evening, if a student is walking towards me, I can't resist saying to them, do you know that's Mars? And pointing it out to people because it's so exciting to me. I like to hope that's helping me, you know, that I can see it there.
Okay, I'm going for a walk in the garden in the dark. I'll try not to fall over.
It's actually a beautiful night.
Is that Orion's belt? I don't know. Yes, yes it is. Orion's belt I can see the North Star. I think I know which one that is. And that's meant to be Jupiter. Is that Mars? I think it's Mars.
Mars is a beautiful dream. Like, Mars is a sci-fi story. You know, what do you see when you see space launches, and what do you see when you see successful landings? You see people working together in ways that's deeply moving.
And I saw a new heaven.
Just as Jennifer's opera is now hurtling from a rather nebulous musical idea, series of ideas, to an opening night with cast and crew and tickets to sell, here I am standing in my garden, looking at Mars through this device in my hand, through my phone, with a very real sense that we are also, as a race, hurtling towards this new interplanetary reality, if you like.
The idea of going to Mars offers a chance to display a type of performative, heroic, rugged self-reliance. I think there's also a lot of young people who feel very hopeless about the future. And there's a lot of young people who feel they're about to be handed over a planet that's on fire, that's burning, and that the future ended.
I can't help thinking that there are few people I trust with the story as much as I trust Jen with her particular combination of deep respect for the subject and yet this amazing ability to capture human brilliance and frailty and creativity and silliness, banality. And I think that whatever we hear from her in July, when it is performed for the first time, it won't be the end of the story for her, and it certainly won't be the end of the story for our relationship with Mars, that's for sure.
I think Musk is really positioning Mars as a sci-fi dream of a beautiful future that we could all have. And there are a lot of people, and understandably so, who need a dream or who want a dream.
You've been listening to the documentary In the Studio from the BBC World Service, which was presented by me, Katie Derham, and produced by Jude Shapiro. It was a Peanut and Crumb production.
I'm Sarah Trelevin, and for over a year, I've been working on one of the most complex stories I've ever covered.
There was somebody out there who was faking pregnancies.
I started, like, warning everybody. Every doula that I know.
It was fake.
No pregnancy.
And the deeper I dig, the more questions I unearth.
How long has she been doing this?
What does she have to gain from this?
From CBC and the BBC World Service, The Con, Caitlin's Baby.
It's a long story. Settle in.
Available now.